It's the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. What do Alice Cooper, Groucho Marx, Raquel Welch, Blondie, the Pointer Sisters, and Kenny Loggins all have in common? They were all managed by my next guest. His name is Shep Gordon, who has led an amazing life, which was the subject of a documentary 3 years ago that Mike Myers made called Supermensch, which I praised as one of the best documentaries of that year. And now he is telling some of his own life story in a book, his autobiography called They Call Me Supermensch. He's going to be here in St. Louis to talk about it at the Jewish Book Festival on Saturday the 19th, and he's here to join me now. Hi, Shep. How are you?
Aloha, Paul.
I love the movie, and I really, really enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
Which was a great read this week. And I've got to ask you about two people who you worked with who are kind of heroes of mine, Groucho Marx and the amazing Randy.
So I love them in the same sentence. Randy would be so happy.
Yeah. I've known Randy for about 30 years, and we'll get to him in just a second. How does Groucho Marx come into your life?
Groucho Marx comes into my life, like everything else, in a very bizarre way. I was managing Alice Cooper. This is back in 1970, maybe 71, right in that era. And Alice called me up on a landline, if anybody remembers what that is, because there were no cell phones.
Yep.
And said he had spent the night with Groucho Marx. And I said, "You got to be kidding me." And he said, "No, it's unbelievable. I got in bed with him and watched TV till he went to sleep."
Wow.
I said, "Well, you got to invite me up next time." So about a week later, he called me up. "I'm going up tonight." Groucho said you could come by, and I came in and got taken into the bedroom, and there was Alice and Groucho in Mickey McGray's gray felt Mickey Mouse ears, both of which said Groucho, watching McHale's Navy or some crazy thing on TV.
Oh, wow.
It was like, wow.
Now, this was during the time when Aaron Fleming was, some say running, some say abusing Groucho's life, right?
Yeah, she was the one who actually hired me. I think, you know, she was very controversial. But my take on it was when Groucho was in the room alone, he was a little slunched over and usually looked a little blank. And as soon as she would walk in the room, he'd get 6 inches taller and be so joyful. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
So anyone who could do that for Groucho, who was one of my heroes, to me was perfect. The thing, she was controversial because she would do things like, it's one of the reasons I got hired. He had lost his second shift of nurses, the night nurses, for financial reasons. And she would sometimes give him a sleeping pill to go to sleep so she could go out. And people freaked out over it. But I understood. For me, it was really simple. Anything that made Groucho happy was perfect.
And so he was essentially broke at the time?
Yeah, it wasn't so much broke. I never really got completely to the bottom of it because my job was to make the money and not really to deal with history. But I believe when I went to meet with his business manager, he had Alzheimer's, but it was before we really knew about Alzheimer's.
Mm.
So I just think he couldn't remember where he put the money. It sounds ridiculous, but that seems to be what happened. He just didn't remember where he put it.
So how did you make money for it? Were you the one responsible for putting together the Evening with Groucho album for A&M?
No, I came in right after that. But what I did is I got the TV show back on television. You Bet Your Life.
Yeah.
Most of the guests, 90% of the guests were SAG actors. They weren't people off the street. And in order to do reruns on television, SAG has a payment schedule.
Sure.
And you couldn't afford it. It would be too expensive to put the show on the air. So we went back and negotiated with all the estates, of those people and got a cut rate so we could get it on the air and make Groucho money.
And that's what made him famous for another generation, like me.
Yeah, what an amazing man.
Yeah, well, that's great. Now let's talk about Randy for a second.
I love Amazing Randy. So Amazing Randy, what a great character.
Yeah.
I'm going to see him, I think, next week in Miami.
Oh, good.
And I loved his documentary.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Which was fantastic.
Yes.
Randy came out of an interesting media phenomenon. We always used characters in Alice's show, so we always had to travel with extra people. We had executioners, we had nurses, and Alice particularly then, he was a serious alcoholic, and he didn't do sound checks, and there was no social media. The only way you could talk to people was through the 6 o'clock news or newspapers. So if we hadn't sold out an arena, and we were doors open, let's say at 8 o'clock, part of the rhythm of touring in those days was that you allowed the TV crew to come to your sound check. That way it would get on the 6 o'clock news. People would know you're in town.
Ah.
You could sell some extra tickets.
Right.
Alice didn't do sound checks, so for us that wasn't a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to think of how can I get the 6 o'clock news without Alice. And somewhere I came across Amazing Randy breaking out of a bank vault.
Uh-huh.
And I said, wow, I wonder if this guy is accessible to get on the road, and maybe every day I could have him break out of a jail or a bank vault for the 6 o'clock news wearing an Alice Cooper T-shirt.
Good.
And talk about being in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did.
And so then he served as the executioner for Alice.
Then he served as the executioner. He played a lot of roles in the show, but the real purpose of him being there was to do that event every afternoon.
Was he influential at all in devising some of the stunts that you used, for instance, the guillotine?
No, not really. He was helpful with us, but he didn't devise it.
Yeah. One of the things he showed me years ago was a gold record that I guess you gave him, and when he showed it to me, it was of Billion Dollar Babies, and I was in rock radio at the time, and I knew that album backwards and forwards, and I noticed that the number of tracks on the so-called gold record of Billion Dollar Babies was not the same as the actual number of tracks on the real album.
Because it's never that record.
No, because why would you take a good-selling record and spray-paint it gold?
Yeah.
You take the DeFranco Family album.
Yeah, exactly what it was. Yeah, something like that, exactly. David Cassidy or something.
Something like that. Now, well, while we're on Alice as a subject here, and you've been friends with him since you started managing him.
Yes, about 47 years, I think.
Then. You say in the book, quote, "In the early days, I didn't think the music alone was strong or distinctive enough to carry them to where we all wanted to get," unquote.
Yeah, that's when we found Bob Ezrin. We all sat in a room, and we, you know, part of being an artist takes, in order to be successful, it sort of takes a family. And part of it is being honest and being able to talk like you talk to normal humans. And I think all of us, certainly for me, I realized that the message they were trying to say in their music was valid, but the picture frame it was in was inaccessible to humans.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing 2.5-minute songs that had 35, 40 musical changes in it.
Wow.
If you listen to Easy Action or Pretty Few, the first two records, you'll hear it's very disjointed. It was sort of like Salvador Dali rock, we used to call it. But we knew that was sort of fixable because they had a message they wanted to tell. And we sat down and we said, whose records do we love the most that are not someone like the Beatles? And the Beatles, their records, we assumed they were very responsible for. We didn't know about George Martin at the time. Rolling Stones. But we said, who is a group that isn't the biggest live group but has hit records that are fantastic? And it was guess who? They had American Woman, which is a great record.
Mm-hmm.
They had some really great records, but they weren't what you would call an important band, which meant to us that somebody was probably helping them.
Yeah.
And that fellow was Jack Richardson, so we decided we would ask Jack Richardson to produce Alice. And instead of him, we got a kid who had just started working for him, Bob Ezrin, which was a lucky break for us.
Yeah, and then you wrote the shows and turned them into the theatrical masterpieces
I helped to write the shows with the band and Lydon. And, you know, we were on such new territory. Nobody was telling a story with a stage show, except on Broadway. Musical shows didn't tell stories. They were a series of songs.
Yeah.
And we decided we wanted to tell stories, that was really the power of Alice Cooper.
But you were also an expert at publicity stunts, as you just mentioned, with the bank vault and Randy. And
yep, I became one.
Yeah.
I realized that when I was in college, I got very lucky. And I pulled off a stunt that had great effect. Well, not my proudest moment, but it was a we were studying for a biology test, we got to a thing called the Thallus of Marcanthia, which is a sex organ of a fern.
Okay.
We had been up for 2 days studying for tests
mm-hmm.
on black beauties, they called them in those days, methadrine.
Mm-hmm.
Completely out of our mind, and someone said, hey, that sounds like the head of a country, Thallus of Marcanthia. And one thing led to another, and we said, well, let's... Why don't we try and pull off a little stunt? We called someone in New York, a cousin of this fellow, Artie Shine, one of the guys I went to school with, who went to the United Nations and sent a Western Union telegram from the United Nations Western Union office to the mayor of Buffalo, saying that the Thallus of Marcanthia was going to be visiting Buffalo, and he wanted it to be, it was his first time to America, would they please give him an important, acceptance.
A proclamation.
Yeah, and we thought, you know, ha, ha, ha. We go to sleep, we wake up, and it's the front page of the Buffalo Evening News that the Thallus of Marcanthia has chosen Buffalo for his first official state visit, an oil-rich country from Africa.
Yeah.
And all the stuff we had fed him.
There's no internet in those days. There's no
internet. There's no Google. There's none of that stuff. They actually fell for it. Now, we're hysterical. We can't believe they fell for it. So we said, well, let's keep following this up. So we take Artie Shine. We all chip in our money. We send him to New York with a sheet from the bed and some pillowcases for his head to fly back up to be met by, because it said the mayor was going to meet him at his plane.
Mm-hmm.
So we send Artie down. We say, well, maybe we could bump this up one more notch. So we call B'nai B'rith, and we say that we can't believe that Buffalo is allowing the Thallus of Marcanthia, the most anti-Semitic ruler in the world today, to come to Buffalo. And 1,500 people came down to the airport and picketed for B'nai B'rith.
Oh, I love it.
They actually went through the window of the airport. Luckily, nobody got hurt.
Wow.
So that was my first realization that you don't have to wait for history. You can sort of create it.
You can make it, yeah. And that's how you end up with stories in the book about Alice Cooper beating up Santa.
Exactly, all that stuff. Yeah. You sort of just create history. Right now we have Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump beating each other up on stage.
Yeah.
During elected.
Yep. Now, I have to ask you about another historic moment in musical history, and I remember this very, very well. In 1985, when the Live Aid concerts took place in London and Philadelphia, and at the time, you'd been managing Teddy Pendergrass for several years, but Teddy had been in a horrible car accident and was essentially a quadriplegic, right?
Yep.
And there was a moment at the Live Aid show at JFK Stadium in Philadelphia where Teddy is in his wheelchair. Well, it's more than a wheelchair. It's the whole thing because he's a quadriplegic.
Yeah, quadriplegic.
And he gets wheeled out on stage, I believe, with Nick Ashford and Mallory Simpson.
Ashford and Simpson.
And the place goes crazy.
Crazy.
Because you had kept him from being seen.
Yeah, the first time he was seen by anybody with no photos, it was nothing. We had never put out a press release. We said nothing. This was the first time, and it was a powerful moment. It was just he got a little scared. When it was time to go on, and I sort of looked at him, and I said, "You know, Teddy, I'm sorry you're scared, but you don't have to sing, but I'm wheeling you up there, and you're going to be in front of these people who love you, and do the best you can do."
And that ovation must have given him the confidence.
Yeah,
to
I think
sing.
You can see in the documentary that little tear that comes to his eye.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful, beautiful moment.
What's it like to play poker with Willie Nelson?
It's a blur.
I'm asking because...
It's really hard to see your cards.
Yeah. The fog of Willie's poker room is a little bit thick.
Oh, my God.
I ask because I'm a poker player, and I can't help but wonder, is everybody giving off the same tell of being just completely stoned?
What's amazing about Willie is that not only is it, 100 joints into the game of the best weed anyone's ever smoked ever.
Yeah.
But he's playing poker at the table with his left hand behind him. He's got a chess game going with Owen Wilson. And with his right hand behind him, he's got a backgammon game going with with somebody else.
Mm.
And he's playing all three, and he wins all three.
Or at least maybe he won. You don't know.
You know, he can't remember. He told us he won.
And then I've also got to ask you about Robert Palmer, who you worked with at a time when he was kind of well-known in what we those days were calling AOR radio, but hadn't really crossed over into Top 40 radio until MTV came around, right?
Yep. And MTV came around, and I had a film company with the fellow who owned his record company, Chris Blackwell.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to me with the management problem, was like, which was, we're getting hit records, but we don't have an identity. How do we really make this more than a hit record artist? I love this artist. He's a real artist. And I had been playing around with an all-girl band called Kit McClure. She was a great saxophone player from the jazz days. And she had put together a swing orchestra of all women.
Mm.
And they played Radio City. They played a couple other places. And I was playing around with, I said, there's got to be something I can do with them. And when he said it to me, I told him. We ended up, I think Robert ended up doing Radio City with the Kit McClure band, as I recall. And then they went to do a video, and when they went to do the video, Chris replaced the Kit McClure band with really good-looking, you know, beautiful, beautiful, sexy women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really changed the rhythm of Palm's career.
Yeah, turned him into a pop star instead.
Turned him into a pop star.
Like I said, an AOR star at the time.
Yeah.
Were all of your deals handshake deals?
Yeah, well, all the deals with my artists were handshake deals. On behalf of my artists, I always made... I insisted on contracts.
Did you ever get screwed by that?
Only one time for a very small amount of money and an unnamed artist.
Okay.
Because my deal was just pay me for my work. At the time, if you want to leave, no problem, but just pay me for what I did.
All right, before I let you go here, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that you are the guy who invented the concept of the celebrity chef. And I did not know until reading your book, Shep, that chefs were really just considered cooks.
Yeah, they were just cooks.
They were the help, and there was no such thing as somebody even getting paid to do a charity benefit.
No, it was sort of like the Chitlin Circuit was. I mean, they had convinced the chefs that in order for their restaurants to stay busy, they had to go out and do all these things all around the country for free.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't valid.
And so who was the first chef who you went to and said, look, I can really do something for you?
You know, they came to me. I had a mentor, Roger Vergier, who was a great chef from France, where they respected chefs. He had the Legion of Honor. He was, you know, he was a hero in France. And
but still being treated wrongly in the kitchen, right?
In America, treated horribly. And I decided I was going to not let him get treated like this anymore. But for me, it was just him. And then I got on an airplane and I went to Hawaii to a Kenny Loggins show. And Wolfgang Puck was cooking the dinner for the concert. It was a Lexus or some car company convention. And Kenny Loggins got a fortune of money, six figures. Wolf didn't get paid. Kenny got treated great. Wolf got treated horribly. There were more people after the show waiting for Wolfgang's meet and greet than Kenny's.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, what's wrong with this picture?
Yeah.
Now, and I talked to Wolfgang about it. And then when I got back to L.A. a few days later, he asked me to come over to Spago. And when I went over to Spago, he had about 50 of the world's great chefs there, Nobu Matsuhisa and Alice Waters and Jonathan Waxman. And they all said, listen, we get treated like Mr. Verger. Please help us, too. And that was the beginning of the agency. So I never really intended to do it. But it seemed like I had the skill set to do it, and it's what I knew how to do.
And all of this because you once stumbled upon Janis Joplin having sex.
Yeah, how lucky am I?
Wow.
Hey, being Jewish.
Hey, I have a quick story about Alice Cooper.
Okay.
And it's a friend of mine and me back in ninth grade, which is about 7-8 years ago.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But a friend of mine who went on to, he's a the guitar player for Dave Matthews right now. His name's Tim Reynolds.
Uh-huh.
We put together a video, and the video had, it, back then, there was no sound with the video.
It was probably Super 8.
Yes, yeah, it was Super 8. Exactly. And we were in my room, my bedroom, and we had bunk beds, and we were on top with a straight jacket and everything. And it was all of this crazy, weird stuff, because that's how we were, and we played "I Gotta Get Out of Here." I gotta get out of here by Alice Cooper. We took that to school in ninth grade. It was a film class. We got an A on that thing. So
wow.
Tell Alice he
I will.
Us
yeah,
an A.
No, that's great.
Do you have to call him Alice, or can you call him Vince?
No one's ever called him Vince in my lifetime.
Wow.
The people who call him Vince are the ones who don't know him, which is really funny. You know, I can almost tell. I'll get, you know, a message. Hey, Vince is my old friend. Could you get me backstage? And I know if they say that, they're not an old friend. Even his mother calls him Alice.
What we have talked about here is the tip of the iceberg of this man's remarkable life. His name is Shep Gordon. He's going to be here in St. Louis at the Jewish Book Festival on Saturday, November 19th, at an event being emceed by my colleague, John Carney, for the book, which is called They Call Me Supermensch. Even if you can't go, get this book, and you will have a great time reading these stories. And it's such a pleasure to share them with you today, Shep. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me. See you in a couple of weeks.
All right. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.